people look at mountaineering and think it's, you know, this metaphor for, you know, winners never quit and the only way is up and blah, blah, blah. It's complete bullshit. Climbers quit all the time. It's absolutely crucial to know when to quit, because we go on to any expedition with two objectives. One is the summit. The other is coming home alive. And the game we're playing, in a sense, is to try and keep those two objectives aligned so that you get both of them.
That's Kathy O'Dowd on the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome back, one and all, to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. And if you're new to the show, around here we do insightful long-form conversations in which I use the lenses of risk and uncertainty to explore all types of topics. For returning listeners, we are back. And in case you're wondering, and if you listen to episode 58, you will know what I'm talking about. I had an amazing experience on the Haute Route Alpes, Nice to Geneva through the Alps, 900 kilometers, 23,000 meters of ascent up some of the most iconic mountains in cycling. It was beautiful. It was also something that involved a lot of suffering and digging deep at certain points, but in the end, it was an amazing experience. I also loved being in the mountains, being high up the mountains, and when doing a descent on the bike, I love the fact that you have to equalize the air pressure in your ears. I love the different smells that you experience going down and then up the mountain. It was just a fabulous experience that I won't ever forget. Now, this week we are also talking about mountains. And this is a conversation that as soon as I finished it, I could not wait to bring it to you. My guest is Kathy O'Dowd. Kathy is an adventurer. She's also a speaker and an author. She was the first woman to have summited Mount Everest from both the north and the south sides. That was in the late 1990s. And in addition to the Himalayas, she's climbed mountains in South and Central Africa, in the Alps, in South America. She's also done a dog sled expedition across the Norwegian Arctic. She's written books, one about her expedition to the Mizzino Ridge. That's called In Some Lost Place. Another book that she wrote is called Just for the Love of It. She speaks and consults to businesses and other organizations. And you, as soon as you start to listen to the conversation, you will understand why. Kathy and I talk about loads of amazing things. Her experiences make her incredibly insightful. So we get into her background. She grew up in South Africa. We talk about her first expedition to Mount Kilimanjaro, her expeditions to Mount Everest. And then we get into some absolutely wonderful insights that are based on Kathy's mountaineering experiences, but we talk about things that are applicable to all walks of life. Things like teamwork, decision-making, risk-taking, and risk assessment under conditions of ambiguity. And when we're talking about high mountains and expeditions, getting it wrong could mean that Kathy or someone in her team pays the ultimate price. And that really focuses the mind. We talk about achievement and performance, failure, leadership, tackling the unknown, and loads of other great things. I loved every minute of this, and I hope that you do as well. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Kathy O'Dowd. Kathy, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. Pleasure to have you on the show. This is going to be fantastic.
I'm delighted to join you, Ben.
To get things going, I wanted to start from your background. I know, obviously, you were the first woman to climb Mount Everest from both sides. You've done all of this all of these wonderful and very interesting expeditions. You're a motivational speaker. You're an author of a couple of books. But is this the kind of thing that you envisaged doing when you were growing up? What was it like growing up as Kathy?
I certainly didn't imagine ending up like this. So I'm South African. I grew up in Johannesburg, which is a big city on a huge flat grass plain. And my family was very suburban. The most adventurous thing we did was go for day walks on the summer holidays. Mm. I think I saw snow twice in my childhood. Once when my father took me to Chamonix, and once when it snowed in Johannesburg for about 20 minutes. So none of that sort of made mountains my future. But I did discover them as a teenager at a sort of a summer camp in the Drakensberg. And I liked hiking and camping. And then I basically found rock climbing at a university, still in Johannesburg. And we have surprisingly good rock climbing in South Africa. Mm. And it was the first sport I'd ever actually been any good at. I don't have great ball coordination. And I don't actually like team sport, not win-lose competitive team sport. Mm. So it was really quite a surprise to discover at 18 that here was a sport that I was actually, you know, apparently any good at. But it wasn't about big goals. Hmm. At no point did I ever want to climb Everest. Not even when I was on the team. Which is not what anybody expects.
Right. How did you get into that then? How did you find your way into an expedition to climb Mount Everest?
Well, I was driven then, and I think I still am, essentially by curiosity. What would it be like to try something? Something that is sort of in the area that I know I enjoy, which tends to be mountain activities, but that will also stretch me. Mm-hmm. So I went from single pitch rock climbing to multi-pitch long routes. I went from that to sort of South African style mad mountaineering. From there to Central Africa, high altitudes, 5,000 meters, to the Andes, 6,000 meters, to spending a summer climbing in the Alps. And the next thing I wanted to do was go to the Himalaya. Mm. But of course, this was before commercial expeditions were a thing. Mm. There were so few teams going out from South Africa. Mm. We were still, you know, we'd only just emerged from the end of apartheid, so there was not a lot of money, there were travel restrictions. It was just complicated. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't see how to get it to work, but I was on the lookout for anything that would get me to the Himalaya. Hmm. And then, splashed across the front page of one of our big Sunday newspapers, was the first South African Everest expedition, and they had a team. The team were all men. But they were also running a rather contrived competition that seemed to have more to do with, you know, increasing the media coverage than it actually had to do with climbing. But still, they were running a competition to find a woman to join the team. Hmm. And they were saying that they'd put together a shortlist of six who'd go and climb Kilimanjaro as a kind of selection expedition come reality TV type of thing. And I figured I had a good shot at the shortlist, given my experience. Then I'd get a free trip to Kilimanjaro and an outside chance at a Himalayan expedition. Hmm. You know, yeah, Everest, that's nice, but I'd have done it for any mountain in the Himalaya. Hmm. And yeah, I ended up being the one who was selected to join the team.
Really interesting, very, you know, certainly fortuitous, when you did the expeditions, well, I don't know if you could you call them expeditions, the different climbs that you did prior to this? I presume you do them in teams as well.
Yes. I mean, I think we call anything an expedition that mm-hmm. starts to involve going off into other countries and remote places. Mm-hmm. So yes, the Andes, the Ruwenzori, the Himalaya, they're all expeditions. They are kind of done in teams. Well, yes, they're done in teams, but the size of the team is much more flexible than people think. Some world-class mountaineering is done alone. That's not my style. I prefer being with other people. But some of these things can be done in pairs. And beyond that, these days, teams tend to be anywhere between 2 and maybe maximum 6 or 8 people.
Okay. What was it like when you joined that team in the Kilimanjaro expedition and then when you went off to do Mount Everest? Was it what you were expecting?
Not exactly. But it had less to do with the mountain and much more to do with the people and the circumstances. So Kilimanjaro is a perfectly straightforward kind of trekking mountain. But the dynamic was kind of weird. I mean, you've got these 6 women competing with each other to get on this team, being judged by a male team leader and then being observed by a male film crew and a male journalist.
Bizarre, yeah.
Yeah, so that was all a little odd. And then the Everest team, Jesus, this is now fairly notorious in the history of international mountaineering. The South African Everest team was just dreadful.
Right.
the dynamic was pretty bad. So for complicated reasons, eventually 2 women got onto the team.
Okay.
But neither of us were welcome. I mean, from at least by part of the team, partly because we were getting all the media attention, despite not being the sort of climbing stars of the team. Then within the men on the team, there was already a major culture clash right from the beginning. But you know, there were certain limitations around who was available. South Africa's, you know, not really a mountaineering nation. There were only a handful of people, you know, who were even possible contenders for this kind of expedition. And then there were restrictions around sort of, you know, race. It had to be an interracial expedition. But this is just post-apartheid. Even now, mountaineering is a desperately white activity. And back then in South Africa, there were not a lot of choices. And, you know, so there were reasons why that this was a group of people who were chosen not for their compatibility with each other, but to fit a whole lot of circumstances around sponsorship and politics and availability and so on.
Right, right. I'm curious, and you know, feel free to draw on other expeditions, but it strikes me, you know, you did describe that this is a team activity, even though there are small teams. And what little I do know about mountaineering is that, you know, you do need to work very closely and very well within a team. So I would imagine that team dynamic matters a lot. But at the same time, you've got people who I would also imagine are high achievers and maybe in some cases are there for reasons of perhaps ego, or you talked about mountaineering stars on that first expedition, and that strikes me as potentially a dangerous chemistry there between needing to work as a team and work for each other, but also having people that you know, they're quite possibly their lives are all about, you know, reaching the summit and achievement. I don't know what that experience was like in that first expedition, but I'm curious around your thoughts and whether or not that was something new or that you dealt with, or if something different was going on, or indeed if you know what I just described doesn't, you know, isn't an issue or doesn't happen as often as we might think outside of the mountaineering world.
Oh, it absolutely happens. You're quite right about the set of dynamics there, and it's quite interesting. So you absolutely get some A-type egos on big mountains, partly because it takes a good deal of self-confidence to put your hand up for something that difficult and with that level of risk.
Sure.
And go like, yeah, I'm the guy to do this. And then because there are a couple of different ways of doing it, it's important that you as a climber, as an individual, or you as a leader of a team, get the right fit and acknowledge the kind of culture you want to work within. Mm. So, because this is not organized sport. There are a lot of different ways of doing this. Mm. So we have the solo superstars, mm-hmm. of whom I think Reinhold Messner was one of the great examples. I mean, astonishing, but very much the leader. Mm. Everyone else was the support crew. Mm. And that's fine. You wanted to be on a Reinhold Messner team, understanding that that was the dynamic. That's how it worked. Then you get the kind of teams where they are individually very good. They are working together because it's easier or safer that way, or they're happy climbing with a climbing partner. Hmm. They're often much less work is put into picking these teams than you'd think. The majority of high-performance mountaineering teams, some high-performance mountaineering teams are based on partnerships that have worked together for years.
Right.
There's a very famous British partnership that is Mick Fowler and Paul Ramsden, mm-hmm. the only climbers to have won the Piolet d'Or, which is kind of the equivalent of winning an Oscar for Himalayan mountaineering. This is for new routes done alpine style. They're the only people ever to have won it three times. Hmm. And they're a partnership that have been climbing together for decades. On the other hand, a friend of mine went out to try a new route. They were trying to go to Choyu. No, they weren't. I'm about to get
that's
that
okay.
wrong.
We can,
anyway,
yeah.
They were trying to go to a mountain in China. China pulled permits for people who had Pakistani stamps in their passports at the last minute. Hmm. They had to change the mountain, and they ended up trying to do a new route in Annapurna. Mm-hmm. So this is four guys, four different nationalities, all of them top climbers. All of them only knew one other man on the team. So that's not what people expect.
Yes.
But it worked. They didn't get up the route. It was too difficult, and the circumstances weren't conducive, dangerous weather and snow conditions. But, you know, that's the other kind of very high-end mountaineering that can happen, where it's about we are all professionals. It's a little bit like work teams sometimes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're all professionals. We've been put together on this project. We need to make it work. Mm-hmm. Then that doesn't always work. You get the expeditions. There was one recently, teams trying to do the first winter ascent of Nanga Parbat, which ended up in a huge fight, which was being played out through the social media following of both of the male superstars involved. So that can happen. And then you get the rest of us, because I'm not in any of those categories. I'm not a world-class climber, although I've done some reasonably good stuff. But I'm the sort of climber who needs all the help I can get, who chooses to climb in teams because I do better that way and I feel safer. And I like having my choices, well, being able to discuss them with other people and kind of second-guess them by taking in with the rest of my team. I'm more motivated when I can share the difficulty and the challenge and the motivation and the disappointment with other people. Mm-hmm. And I'm more excited as well when I get to share, you know, the joy and the achievement with the people.
When you said, you know, you're not a world-class climber, well, what makes a world-class climber, and how does that even get judged? In other, you know, athletic pursuits, we can measure time and speed and goals scored and, you know, all of these other things. But when you say so-and-so is a world-class climber, what makes them that?
It's a little less formal than mm-hmm. other sports. As I said, there isn't a world ranking mm-hmm. or anything like that. There is absolutely a pecking order. And again, it's kind of informal, but there are a bunch of questions you can ask people about what mountains they've climbed and how they did them. You know, it is absolutely not enough to say I climbed Everest.
Right.
These days, Everest is new. It's the new midlife crisis.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Where in the 1990s, the investment banker went and bought himself a Lamborghini. Nowadays, right. He goes and buys himself an Everest expedition.
Right. Isn't it that am I correct in saying that they've closed Everest, or they temporarily halted expeditions for a period of time or something like this because it got so crowded, or it's getting so crowded? Is that correct?
No.
Okay. All right. No. Okay.
There's a lot of fuss about crowding.
Right.
Although it's a little contrived. I mean, the crowding is nothing compared mm-hmm. to what's going on Mont Blanc, which is Europe's most famous mountain every summer. Mm-hmm. The Nepalese are taking everyone they can get on Everest because they need the money. Mm. The Chinese do sometimes close Everest, but for strange, inscrutable Chinese reasons, not for anything that has, I think, particularly to do with crowding.
Okay.
But yes, these days, the kind of commercial Everest ascent where you're taken up there by a guide, your equipment is carried by a Sherpa, you're plugged into oxygen halfway up the mountain.
Right.
That's not going to earn you any respect in the climbing community.
Sure.
You know, you want respect as a climber, you can get that on Everest, but you'd probably need to be either doing one of the really difficult routes that's seldom repeated, mm-hmm. because there are, I think, 15 routes on Everest at the moment, possibly 16. Mm-hmm. And you need to be doing it, no Sherpa support, no oxygen. Mm-hmm. And if you really want respect, there are at least two possible unclimbed lines on Everest that have never been done. And they're on the east face. There will be nobody else there.
Right.
I tried once long ago. And honestly, we got nowhere. Hmm. We basically got to the mountain, had a look and went, well, the one route is way too dangerous. Hmm. And the other route we didn't even make 6,000 meters before mm-hmm. realizing there was just, we had no chance mm-hmm. of making it work. But yes, that is truly isolated on the east face of Everest. So, you know, you can do world-class mountaineering on Everest still. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these days climbers are more likely to be on the other big mountains chasing. I think one of the big outstanding records, nobody's done the first winter ascent of K2, second highest in the world. Mm. Or increasingly, the Piolet d'Or awards tend to be given to climbers who are doing really technically difficult first ascents of unclimbed mountains.
Okay.
And it's all about the element of technical difficulty combined with the element of exploration.
Okay. That makes sense. Yes. But even in that, you know, even if you have world-class climbs, or perhaps, I guess I'm curious, we can maybe segue into one of the things I wanted to talk about, which I've heard you discuss, which was around team dynamics. And we'll get back to your first Everest expedition. But in your experience working with various teams, what works and what doesn't? When do teams get it wrong, and why is that?
I think a couple of things help. Mm-hmm. One is an agreement on the culture of the team. So there are many different ways of climbing mountains mm-hmm. and many different approaches, many different reasons for doing it. And some of them clash. So you want to start by either putting together, you know, people you like, who you know share your outlook, or if you're kind of selecting a more formal team, by being very clear with yourself about what the culture is that you want to cultivate as the team leader, and then making an effort to make sure that people aren't just kind of superstars in terms of their curriculum vitae, but are actually share your ethic and your approach to the project. I think it can also be important to say that kind of climbing superstars aren't always your best bet. Mm-hmm. They aren't always that good at collaborating. And you can do better with a team that maybe are not individually as experienced, but where everyone agrees that we're in this together. We need all the help we can get. We're going to help each other out, and we're going to work our way towards this project mutually. That doesn't mean everybody gets to the top. There are a lot of reasons why people may need to kind of stand down about health or weather or emotional response to the mountain or altitude, whatever it is. But you're still working together to try and get as many people as you can to the top and try and get everybody safely off the mountain.
Right, right.
I think another thing that makes a big difference is to acknowledge that a great deal of it isn't about the technical difficulty of the climb or about surviving the weather or the cold or the altitude. Success or failure has a lot to do with the dynamic within the group and then the emotional response of individuals to the circumstances on the mountain. And a lot of climbers, just like a lot of business people, don't want to talk about so-called soft skills and don't want to talk about emotional responses. They're all about technical, you know, achievements and equipment lists and the kind of thing that can be put on a spreadsheet or that doesn't involve emotions and, you know. But the truth remains, whoever you are, no matter how stoic you are, emotions are going to play a part, and the interpersonal dynamic is going to play a part. And teams do better if they acknowledge that and are able to talk openly about it.
Wow, that's very profound. There's a lot of great stuff in that. What is it? Have you had the experience of being the one who doesn't make it to the top, and you know has to wait, or? What is that like? You do all this preparation, and you know, what is that feeling?
It's in the moment, it's just fine. Mm-hmm. Okay, at least in my experience, because the times that has happened to me, and it has happened a couple of times, it wasn't a situation where I thought I should go on and everyone else was trying to awkwardly say, you're the weakest link, this isn't working. In each case, I was at my personal limit, because this isn't a situation where there's a team leader who is kind of giving orders in an army style. Mm. This is a set of individuals who've put their hand up for a potentially fairly risky objective, and they're essentially doing it for fun because they want to. And you can't really order them to do something that they believe is truly dangerous.
Sure.
So people tend to reach individual limits. The other thing you of course, the other thing works. The team leader can potentially say, I think the situation is too risky. And the rest of the team can say, well, we don't agree. And we're going to keep going. Mm-hmm. So you, as an aside, you often have to lead by persuasion.
Right.
Rather than by orders. And honestly, a lot of these teams have a very flat leadership structure. Sometimes so flat that you can be kind of paralyzed if you can't reach an agreement. But nevertheless. So I just got sidetracked.
No, we were talking about team dynamics and
me stepping down.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In all the cases where I said, I'm stepping down, I'm not going on, it was partly because I felt that it was personally too dangerous. And it was partly because I also then felt that if I kept on pushing, I potentially endangered the rest of the team. Because, you know, when people talk about injury and rescue and, you know, there's a bit of a, I don't know, a meme about climbers being selfish on big mountains and looking out for themselves, not looking out for each other. Mm-hmm. There's also an individual responsibility that says, I as a team member must turn round while I still have working legs. Mm. Bottom line is, it's incredibly difficult to rescue somebody who isn't sort of mobile still, as in they can stumble on their own two legs.
Yes.
The minute you have to carry them, it's an absolute nightmare, and they're probably going to die. So I need to stand down while I can still get myself down the mountain. Otherwise, I've just almost certainly lost us the summit for everybody, and I've endangered the lives of the climbers who are potentially going to have to try and help me.
I imagine that requires a huge amount of self-awareness of your own limitations, and when you're pushing yourself to that sort of limit, and knowing where that limit is and when you potentially could cross it.
Absolutely. But that's part of why it's so interesting. Mm. And it's not that awareness of limits isn't just about an individual standing down. People look at mountaineering and think it's, this metaphor for, winners never quit and the only way is up and blah, blah, blah. It's complete bullshit. Climbers quit all the time. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely crucial to know when to quit because we go on to any expedition with two objectives. One is the summit. Mm-hmm. The other is coming home alive. Mm. And the game we're playing, in a sense, is to try and keep those two objectives aligned so that you get both of them. But circumstances entirely out of your control can mean that those two objectives start to drift. That by continuing to focus on the summit, you make it more and more likely that not everyone will get out of it alive.
Right, right.
You have to recognize that drift. And it can drift kind of slowly. You've got to recognize that drift. It's all happening in a big gray area. There are no hard lines. Again, it's a bit of a meme that there's some sort of mythical time on your summit day when the clock strikes 2 o'clock in some time zone. That's the pumpkin hour and you must turn around now. It's not like that at all. Most of your decisions are taken in an amorphous gray zone of maybe this will work and maybe it won't. And in that zone, you are trying to make the call. Do we give up on the summit in the interests of getting out of here alive? And people don't always get the call right. There's a situation playing out right now on K2, which of course is a mythical mountain. We've just had the first American woman ever to climb K2, Vanessa O'Brien, a couple of days ago. A very well-known expedition leader called Russell Bryce from the UK pulled his commercial expedition off K2 because he said the conditions weren't good enough. They weren't safe enough. And days later, Vanessa and a bunch of other climbers got to the top. So I don't know the details of this. Maybe Vanessa and her compatriots took some chances and were just bloody lucky. Maybe Russell Bryce was too conservative. Who knows? But that's a classic problem of operating in the gray area. And you make one choice, other people make other choices. Maybe you were brilliant, maybe you were lucky. It's very hard to know.
Isn't it that three-quarters of attempts, is it Everest that three-quarters of attempts don't, that they fail in terms of reaching the summit?
I think that figure is slightly out of date.
Okay.
I ran the statistics at one time from the first attempt, which I think was 1922, through to the year 2000. And at that point, yes, there was a 75% failure rate. Now that the commercial expeditions have more or less got a safety rope running from base camp to the summit, the success figures are now higher because they have created this very safe but honestly not very interesting way of climbing Everest. But even with the commercial expeditions, there is in no sense guaranteed success. It doesn't matter how many tens of thousands of dollars you shell out to your leader.
Sure.
It doesn't come with guaranteed success.
This is fascinating stuff, Kathy. I'm enthralled. There's so many ways we can go here. One of the areas though I wanted to explore a bit was this decision making, this concept of decision making under circumstances of what you call the gray zone, this ambiguity between making it and not, and is it do you feel like you're a very experienced mountaineer now, and do you feel like it's a kind of a roll of the dice that you've kind of you're in a position where you can kind of have a view of the likelihood or the probability of making the right call, or was it a roll of the dice, or is there a way of making those kinds of decisions more effectively, do you think?
It's somewhere in between. So there are absolutely ways of trying to make your decisions as effective as possible. Mm-hmm. But there remains an element of luck. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, to have a certain humility when we're making decisions. And one of the problems with mountaineering is that you never know which bullets you dodged, which can leave successful climbers being more and more convinced that their decision-making is just brilliant.
Right.
So to give you an example from a field where there's a lot more specific research than there is in kind of high-altitude mountaineering, and this is backcountry skiing, which, of course, is something that you know, millions of people do around the world. There's a lot of research done into backcountry skiing. Yeah. And it's something that I passionately do as a winter sport, ski mountaineering. Because one of the big risks of backcountry skiing is avalanche. Mm-hmm. The particular kind of avalanche that is at risk is something called a wind slab, where the wind has transformed the snow into a bonded slab, completely invisible to the human eye, lying on the kind of angle of slope that is the most fun to ski, which is about 35 to 40 degrees. And the thing about the wind slab is it is stable, as in it probably won't collapse on its own, but it will collapse under just a little bit of extra weight, and the body weight of a skier is enough. So we as backcountry skiers tend ourselves to trigger the avalanches that then kill us. And we do a whole lot of training about how to recognize these kind of slopes and about how to avoid them. And it's not just about the snow conditions and the weather and the angle. It's also about the dynamic of the team, about backing off, about not getting caught up with sort of first track. You know, mountains, we talk about summit fever. Skiers have first track fever. The first person down the virgin snow slope after the big snowstorm, powder fever. And, you know, there's some fascinating research into this, including that one of the safest ways to avoid this kind of powder fever is to have a woman on the team. Because women are less likely to get caught up in young man, ego-driven. Nobody's going to admit that they're the weak link. They're the one who's worried. Group decision-making has been proved not to always be safer, because people look at each other and think, well, if everyone else thinks it's okay, then I won't voice my doubts. I don't be seen as the most timid person. And women are just that much less likely to be afraid of being seen as to be timid. But what I'm actually going with this is that we ski those slopes after snowstorms, and every time we ski them, we think, I judged it right. I have reinforced my belief in myself as a good decision maker when it comes to judging avalanche slopes.
But we
can ski across these wind slab slopes. They've got things that we think of as trigger points. If you think of them as like landmines, invisible landmines, we can have skied straight between two landmines, not triggered either of them, and no idea that we got away with it from pure luck. Our success is self-reinforcing, because we don't know that we dodged the landmines.
That is fascinating.
And they've proved with the skiing research that experts can kill themselves almost as often as amateurs. The circumstances are slightly different. Amateurs will probably trigger an avalanche in unknown country. Experts will probably trigger an avalanche on their home ski ground, because they've done it so often, they assume, oh, it's always safe here.
I know.
I can, yeah. I know there's a high avalanche avoidance, but you know, high avalanche warning risk.
Mm.
But this is my backyard. I know what I'm doing. And the people who do best are the avalanche experts who are forced to retrain every year and get reminded of all the ways in which they're not as good as they think they are.
Right. Right. That's amazing. Yes. This is a phenomenon that you can observe in a lot of places in the financial services world, right? If a fund manager has a good year, that might have been because of pure luck. And they take, you know, and they might have taken a number of risky bets, and the next year they do the same until they, you know, one year they, you know, their decision making leads them to, you know, lose a ton of money, and there have been books written about this in other places. So yes, this concept of attributing something to skill when it might have been luck is
it's exactly the same. I mean, you know, I've been around for a while. Mm. I watched, you know, the 2000s play out and all those books that came out. I personally built this company,
yes,
and founded this venture capital firm and made this mega millions. And then the crash came. Nobody wrote any books about how I personally crashed the market, this venture firm, or brought down this bank.
Yes.
Suddenly that was all about, ooh, market conditions out of our control, and couldn't possibly have seen it coming. And yeah, climbers do the same thing.
Yes.
You know, that storm, that, you know, set of unbelievable black swan circumstances, bad luck out of our control. Whereas the success is always, oh, good judgment, for which I personally take, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, it is very interesting. So you think that by going back to sort of first principles every year and thinking about the ways in which things can go wrong on whether it's backcountry skiing or an expedition, that's a way of dealing with this?
I absolutely think it helps. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that interests me. Mm-hmm. So an expedition that interests me, that I often use as a case study with my corporate clients, isn't Everest. It was a number of years later when I was part of a team that tried to do a new route on Nanga Parbat. Mm. We were a team of six, and we succeeded up to a point in that we got two of the six to the top in some very pushy circumstances. Mm. They were lucky to get down in one piece, which they did. There were a few tips of toes lost to amputation, but it was, you know, more or less one piece. But I think that we could have done better. We could have got all six to the top, but we made a couple of mistakes. Hard not to make mistakes, very hard. Mm. And we'd have had to have made almost no mistakes, I think, to get all six to the top, but we could have. We did that. We did our first summit attempt and fluffed it.
Hmm.
And then we simply didn't have the supplies for everyone to try again. But honestly, four of us were, myself included, were up to our eyeballs in terms of risk limit.
Hmm.
It was just like, I want to get the hell off this mountain at this point. I am so done. This was alpine style. We were already 12 days in. We only had 10 days of food. So we were out of food. We were almost out of gas, no water. Still 2 days climbing to get off the mountain by a route we'd never seen because we were traversing the mountain. I was like, I want to get off this mountain. But as I said, two guys went on. They took 18 days to finish the climb.
Wow.
On no food for nearly a week and no water for about 3 days. But I still think that the reasons we didn't get all six of us to the top had less to do with the mountain itself. We were actually incredibly lucky with snow conditions and weather conditions, and more to do with making three key mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And the first was that we had two kinds of expertise in the group, deliberately, because we were trying to solve a problem other teams had tried and failed already, so we had a fair amount of information. We were trying to solve a problem about the difficulty of the distance, carrying enough supplies, and breaking trail in soft snow.
Mm.
So half the team were Sherpa climbers for their now proved to be genetic, astonishing ability at altitude. And these guys were just machines for breaking trail in snow. And then kind of the other half of the team, particularly Rick and Sandy, brought in extraordinary depth of expertise in doing new things. These guys had climbed new routes on mountains right around the world. Whereas the Sherpas, despite being physically incredibly strong, essentially climb the same route on the same five commercial mountains over and over and over again. And we got in a situation where the Sherpas, with their physical strength, were blazing the trail out in front. The expertise was kind of stuck at the back, battling to keep up.
Okay.
There was so much stuff that needed to be done just on a daily basis, just to keep going. Think of the things that are, how does the matrix go? Urgent, but not always.
Yeah, urgent and important. Yes, yeah. Things that are urgent or not urgent and important, more or less important. Yeah.
Exactly. So this is the stuff that was urgent. It needs to happen now. But there was so much urgent stuff that there wasn't enough space spent thinking about the big picture important things, like in the big picture, are we still going in the right direction? And we did end up fluffing the summit bid by not choosing the correct direction, by putting the top camp in too low, a set of strategic mistakes. And they're like, okay, so why did we end up with a division between these two kinds of strength expertise? You know, how difficult is it for six people to communicate?
Right.
But we, like people, found that there were barriers to communication we hadn't thought about. Literally, during the day, incredibly cold, so much clothing over your ears, you can't talk to each other unless you're standing right next to each other. But we're climbing on a knife edge ridge. Safety dictates that you climb in roped pairs. The rope is only functional as a safety device if it's strung out between you. You are 30 meters apart for the entire day. That's how it works. You know, this is a simplification, but basically. And then as soon as you stop, we are in two-man tents because this was the lightest way of carrying tents. And every extra gram of tent you're carrying is less food and less gas, which means less water. You know, you're not going to sacrifice food and water to take some nice big tent where six of you can sit together and have a committee meeting. But it did mean that there was no easy way for six of us to sit together and have a thoughtful discussion about the big picture. And then the last thing that happened, we're under incredible pressure because we're too slow. We've got this deadline of food and water. We literally have 10 days. It's Alpine style. That's all the food and water we have with us. And we can see the clock ticking down. This is like these stupid movies that are always on an artificial tick down time limit. You know?
Yes, yes. The bomb going off. Yeah.
Exactly. We're on this ticking down 10-day thing, and we are falling behind almost from day one. Yeah, you know, we literally make that first summit bid on day 11. So we're under this acute pressure. There are always too many of these urgent things that need to be done now to think about the big picture important stuff. So we stick to the plan. This is the plan we drew up at base camp at the beginning. As long as we're executing the plan, surely we're doing the right thing. But of course, because we're trying to do something that's never been done before, the plan isn't some kind of...
That's right. It's not a Bible. It's not...
It's not a set of directions the way there is now a kind of a set of directions about how to climb Everest by the Hillary route. You know, it's so well known. It's just our best hope. You get on the mountain. The conditions are not what you expect. Circumstances change. You need to change the plan. And then if, you know, we've stuck to the plan while reality has been doing a big swerve off in a different direction. At some point, we actually need to bloody dump the plan.
But you need to sit down together to do that.
And that's kind of what happened after we fluffed the first summit bid. Then we sat down together and said, okay, dump the plan. The plan is history. It didn't work. Start again. this is what we've got left. This is what each individual person thinks they're capable of. These are the circumstances. What do we do? Mm-hmm. Four of us said, okay, we think we can climb ourselves out down the shell route. And it's the only way we can think of safely getting the hell out of here. And we'll climb for 2 days on no food to get out. Mm-hmm. And two of us said, and this was Rick and Sandy. It wasn't the Sherpas who have the strength expertise. It was the two guys with the strategic expertise, mm-hmm. the depth of experience. Mm-hmm. They said, we're up for trying this again. And we know that this is potentially a killer choice because it is so out there. But we're going to try anyway. And it's like, yeah, okay. Your choice. That's okay.
Right, right.
So what interests me then is the way we kind of clung to the plan as a safety net.
Yeah.
And it was a mistake.
Yes.
We needed to be much more flexible about adapting the plan to the reality. To do that, we needed to be more thoughtful about the information we were getting on a daily basis about the reality. And to do that, we needed much cleaner, rapid communication about what each of us are individually seeing and what that means for our plan as a group.
It reminds me of that Eisenhower quote that says, all plans are useless, but planning is useful, or something like that.
Absolutely. I mean, we needed a really thoughtful plan to have any kind of shot. We needed to be going in the right direction, know where the route was, have weather information coming into us, have made thoughtful choices about how much food and gas and clothing to carry and what kind of tents we should be using and how the safety would work. Mm-hmm. Then we also needed to be able to embark on the project and accept that all that thoughtful planning can be changed. Not to be too wedded to it.
Mm-hmm. And is that a lesson that you would take away around when things go wrong in other contexts? Is there something that's sort of that you can translate into other domains? Do you think about that experience?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually an idea that is really quite relevant as companies increasingly try and take on the flexibility of a startup, even if they are actually, you know, a big giant in their industry. They talk about being nimble and adaptable, able to change rapidly. I also think that that's increasingly important as we move into this incredibly unpredictable world. Mm-hmm. You know, we're linked into this global economy. So we're affected by things that happen on the other side of the planet that had nothing to do with us. Mm-hmm. And then we're in this new economic environment post-crisis where it's kind of a little less obvious what the right choices are anymore. Mm-hmm. And then we've got, you know, even Western governments who, you know, produce Trump or Brexit or, you know, mm-hmm. No, none of that helps anybody feel that we know what things are going to look like a year from now, let alone have some kind of five-year plan. Mm-hmm. You know, I find more and more corporate executives I meet talking about kind of the VUCA dynamic.
Yes.
Volatile, uncertain, complex. And what's the A?
Ambiguous.
Ambiguous. Exactly. And so this is exactly the kind of environment in which you need to have done your planning, but also be prepared to change your plan based on new information, which means that your different experts within your teams need to be communicating with each other rapidly, frequently, and, you know, park their ego when it comes to taking information from other experts, not just be kind of competitive and in silos.
Yes. I think we have a big problem in that in organizations, in any context, even a social context, in either saying two aspects to this. One is saying, I don't know. You know, we're always pressing each other for responses and a view. And secondly is, you know, people simply saying, I was wrong about that. It happens in many organizations, and in the case of mountaineering, if you you know, you don't admit to not knowing, or maybe admitting to yourselves that you got it wrong. I mean, that the consequences are catastrophic. So it really, I did want to talk about death to be and purpose around why you do this, because I think that really sharpens your focus, doesn't it, around decision making?
Absolutely. And I think this is the one huge difference between mountaineering and business. I think there are similarities. I mean, those are the similarities I bring to my corporate clients, but there is a huge difference, and I don't know how you solve it, because I think it's a weakness for companies. We have skin in the game, and in a sense, our choices can kill us on these big mountains, and we get feedback on poor choices reasonably quickly.
Yes.
Things go wrong fast on mountains, and our projects are reasonably short. You know, you're out on a mountain for a month or 2 months, maybe an Arctic expedition is more like 4 or 5 months, but still. The consequences are immediate, and you bear the cost, or at least your team members bear the cost. In business, it can come back to bite you several years later.
Sure.
The people who bear the consequence are often not the executives who made the decisions. Mm. They can be other people, and they can be truly remote. I mean, I'm really surprised every time a company says to me, oh, well, you know, we don't face risk the way that you do. And I think, you know, all those people, actual people with pensions that were affected by the pension funds, that were affected by the worldwide economic crisis, those were real people who faced real risk, real consequences. But it's so remote from the people who are making decisions about investments. And that's the one of the problems with business.
Yes.
They're making risk decisions that have real consequences, but they're consequences for utterly remote people they will never meet, and the consequences will only come home years later.
Yeah, absolutely. It's either, you know, you've got shareholders that might suffer, or people that have, as you say, pension fund holders, or employees, or whomever, and they call, in economics, this is called the principal agent problem, that the principals are the sort of the owners or the stakeholders, and the managers are kind of the agents. So they're carrying out the principal's orders, if you like, but they, you know, they're making decisions and don't feel the immediate consequences. Whereas, you know, I don't want to go into this too much, but I do, if I'm not mistaken, you had a death in the first Everest expedition. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you also had to make a very difficult choice in, was it 1999, around leaving a climber behind?
Yes. So the first one was a member of our team who disappeared. So we don't know what happened. The body was found subsequently by another expedition, but even then, we still don't know what happened. You know, it's not as if the body is brought down to the mountain. It would have been too risky. So there's no autopsy. Best guess is he probably had a stroke. And there's not a great deal you can do about that, you know, at sort of 8,700 meters on Everest.
Sure.
The second one, again on Everest, again very high, 8,600 meters roughly. A member of another team. They'd made some very risky choices, just two of them, a couple. So no oxygen, no team, no backup, no radios. Got to the top, took too long to get to the top. She collapsed on the way down. He left her to go for help and fell and vanished. He was found several years later. And we found her after she'd already been up there, collapsed, dying for, a day and a half or something. And there was nothing we could do that was going to save her life. Again, a difficult concept for people sitting in the cities who normally think, when they say, oh, well, I'd have done something, what they mean is they'll pull out their mobile phone and they'll phone the emergency services.
Yes.
There are no emergency services.
Yes.
There is no one to phone. There's literally just what we can physically do and the number of hours of life she still has left. And it, you know, the maths didn't add up. Nothing was going to save her. And we couldn't even stay with her in the last hours of her life because we had tipped into seriously putting our own lives at risk from hypothermia by trying to stay.
So
at that point, we turned away and I went down. Three of us went down and two people went on, two Sherpas went on to the summit. Either way, you know, it comes back to the big question of why the hell would you do that?
I was going to ask that, yes. Well, in terms of why do you do these expeditions, I guess, is that what you were getting at?
Well, why do you do things that have real risk attached to them?
Yes.
Well, partly because life comes with no guarantees. Yeah. My brother, much older brother, died at 21 in a car crash because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. You know, just because you decide to stay in the house and wrap yourself in cotton wool doesn't guarantee that you'll live to be 90. Then there's kind of some of the most interesting things in life involve risk. They just do. I mean, wrapping yourself in cotton wool, you know, and sitting on the sofa for the next 9 decades just isn't that interesting. It doesn't feel like a life well lived.
No, it doesn't make you happy or fulfilled, that's for sure.
So, you know, each person finds their own answer to what they find interesting and challenging. Each person has their own kind of ability and sets out to live up to their own potential. For me, it's about mountains. I don't go out there thinking I'm playing Russian roulette. I go out there thinking I've put effort and thought and training into understanding the risks, building up my skill set, doing the research for this particular project, choosing people to go with who I think bring, you know, additional skills and judgment to the project. I go out there thinking I understand the risk and I have a plan for avoiding it. And yeah, okay, absolute bad luck can happen. And I do understand the human dynamic of kind of maybe kidding ourselves a little bit about how we're going to avoid the risk that catches other people. But we're still going into it thoughtfully, having done my level best to make the right plan, and going into it being absolutely prepared to fail. Said, I've walked away from projects, and that's okay. I think it's a win to have looked at a situation, gone, oh no, this is getting too risky, and then managed to safely extract yourself. You know, yeah, okay, you don't get the same level of kudos from other people. But personally, I think of those experiences as a win. Because I got, you know, I accepted that one of my two goals was now out of reach, and I hit my other goal, which was to get out in one piece.
And as you said before, you have skin in the game. And I think that there's, it doesn't have to be mountaineering. I think there are a number of things that are on the rise now, that are very increasingly popular, whether we're looking at, you know, obstacle course events, or ultra running or ultra cycling, or just even just pure physical activity. I did a 100-mile ride on Sunday here in London. There were, I think, 30,000 cyclists. Hugely, you know, hugely popular event, and I think it's nowhere near what you've done, but it's the type of thing that make people, you know, it makes us feel alive, right? And that's perhaps what we're missing a little bit in business as well. I think a lot of employees are feeling that sort of sense of detachment between the objectives of whoever, and then trying to deliver something for your employer. Which may be a way of, there might be a way of bridging that gap, so that we also de-risk a number, or reduce risk in, whether it be our financial system or our companies or whatever. But it's a tricky puzzle.
it's a tricky puzzle, and I think it's not helped by I don't know, maybe the edge is off this slightly, but I'm not convinced. By living in a culture where we're pursuing ever bigger, ever more short-term returns at a rate that I just don't understand how it's sustainable. I don't understand how any company can be pushed to produce double-digit growth figures forever. I mean, how does that work? I don't get it.
Yes.
And I watch employees, you know, these are the kind of people who will be in the audience at my speeches and I get to talk to them afterwards. And they talk about, you know, trying to chase targets and they're never allowed to reach them because the minute they succeed, the target is immediately made bigger.
Yes, yes.
And they're then told to run after it even faster.
Yes.
With possibly fewer resources.
Yes, yes.
To do it. And they get told that somehow if they're just sufficiently motivated and go-getting, it'll be possible.
Yes.
And you can see them sagging under the weight of that because eventually there is a point where you say, like, no, it's not possible. It's not true that every target can be reached if you're simply motivated enough.
Yes, yes. it's a similar analogy to, you know, just making, you know, making the summit for the sake of doing it. What you were talking about earlier. That perhaps we have this misperception around, yes, if we, you know, work hard enough, you know, and are motivated enough that we'll always, you know, hit the summit. When a goal is that, you know, that difficult and onerous, a lot more nuance is required, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think there's an interesting sort of psychological phenomenon whereby we kind of produce symbols as a shortcut to stand for the bigger project, and then we chase the symbols. So on Everest, the kind of the new generation of commercial climbers who don't want to climb mountains, they just want to have climbed Everest. That's it. And but they want to be able to say, you know, me and Edmund Hillary,
right,
you know, conquerors together.
Yes, yes.
They completely miss the fact that what Edmund Hillary did was all about doing something that had never been done before, was truly difficult. And reaching the summit of Everest was kind of just the goal that was set by a generation of mountaineers who were trying to work out whether it was even possible for man to climb the highest mountains in the world. Nowadays, you know, being escorted up Everest with a Sherpa carrying your kit and the guide who's done it 17 times telling you, you know, what to do each day and a fixed safety rope from base camp to the summit.
Yes.
That's not what Hillary did.
Yes.
They've mistaken the symbol, which is I climbed Everest, for the truth, which was man challenging himself by trying to do something that had never been done before, trying to push the boundaries of what was thought to be possible. And I think we live in a generation that is increasingly after the shortcut.
The hack, kind of, yes.
Yeah, the hack, the Insta fame, whether you're hacking your social media numbers or hacking your way to, you know, superstar singing fandom, famedom via one of the competitions to hacking your way to riches versus some kind of financial cheat. We're constantly looking for shortcuts because we value the outcome over the process.
That's profound. Yes, I think that's so wonderfully put. Kathy, really, really well phrased. I'm conscious of time, and I know that we need to wrap up soon. But was there anything that we didn't get to? I know there's loads of stuff, but that we can dive in and maybe I'd love to have you back. But was there anything that we didn't cover that you think is relevant to my listeners? Who, by the way, I think are going to love this.
I don't think so. I think we've done a fairly good sort of roundup of all the ways that sort of risk assessment in mountaineering is really interesting. Because in the end, that's how I think of it. I think of it as game playing, a sort of, I don't know, a real world three-dimensional version of video games almost in a sense. Because you do go out there, you have this environment you can't fully predict, you can't fully control, but you can bring to it knowledge, skill, experience, a great group of people, research. And then you move into this environment and you try and control the risks and you try and make your two objectives. Make your summit, get out alive, know when to choose when you're deep into the gray area. And then having pulled yourself out, you look back and go like, huh, okay, what went right? What did we go wrong? You know, how much was luck? How much was good judgment? And then you take that increased knowledge and skill and confidence and expertise and you go and do it again. Go and pick a new objective. That's what makes mountaineering so interesting. That's why who cares whether or not I've climbed Everest? It's about what I learned on all these mountains, Everest included, and then what can come next, you know, based on what I've learned already.
The what can come next point is an interesting one, because I can see if someone, back to the discussion about, you know, making it through backcountry skiing unscathed when it might have just been luck, but I think there, and I can feel this for myself, but once we achieve something, we want to go for something bigger and then bigger and then bigger and then bigger. And I think we can get, people can get depressed if, you know, after reaching the summit or after finishing the first marathon or obtaining this thing. So maybe quickly before we go, maybe dealing with that what's comes next question, how you deal with that might be a great way to maybe wrap it up.
Yes, I think that's really interesting, because different people have different motivations and it helps to understand your personal motivation. So there's definitely a set of people in the world who are inspired by competition and inspired by achievement. And I think they can often make the best athletes because they're literally chasing records and motivated by beating others. But it's a tough step down because at some point you've got to accept that you've peaked. You've run your fastest race. You've climbed your hardest mountain. And you somehow need to pivot. And some of those people successfully then move on to into business or a new career where they can chase a new different set of goals. And they may often simply literally step away from their sport and never do it again. But at some point you're going to have to retire. And that, you know, strikes me as being particularly difficult. At some point you are now never going to be that good at anything again. And I don't know how those people cope at that point, because I'm not one of them.
Yes. Well, there are a lot of people who attach an identity to an achievement or a thing that they are. And I think it's particularly hard for athletes. If you were, you know, this sort of high level elite athlete at something and that's how you identified yourself, then it's difficult to let go of that identity because a part of you is you've lost a part of yourself.
That's particularly hard because they peak so young. I think in business, you probably peak a lot later. In athletics, you peak young and your record can fall, you know, not for all athletes, but for some, quite quickly after you retired. So you're forgotten with a brutal rapidity. And I notice increasingly that there are experts, actually, you know, consultants designed to help athletes transition.
Right.
Because that is such a difficult problem. Even in mountaineering, it's slightly less brutal, but there's a really interesting guy you actually might want to talk to, Dr. Nathan Smith.
Okay.
He's doing postdoc research in the UK into post-expedition depression, among other things.
Right,
right. You know, literally how high achievement people cope with having achieved and being faced with the, you know, the gloomy valley of what's next.
Yes.
But to come back to the dynamic of kind of two different kinds of motivation, the other kind of people are the ones who are, they're in it for the journey. They're in it for the unfolding experience and the fascination of the new challenge. It doesn't have to be hard or as hard. It just has to be interesting, engaging. And I'm squarely in the second camp. So I probably will never do a mountain as outrageously risky as the Mazena Ridge of Nanga Parbat, which is the one I was talking about, the new
yes.
route.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a conscious choice. I got pretty freaked out by the time I eventually called it quits and said, I'm at my limit. And that was enough.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm in my late 40s. My knees creak a bit, you know. I can see that. I'm realistic about that. But I still really like climbing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mind if it's not as hard. I just want it to be interesting.
Right.
And I live in the Pyrenees Mountains so that I can walk out of my front door and find interesting things to do locally. And I still do expeditions. Last year, I did a ski ascent of a nearly 20,000 foot peak, second highest in North America, because I'd never skied a high altitude mountain and I wanted to try.
Hmm.
You know, my something I've got my eye on now is a mountain that's never been climbed before. Hmm. And it probably won't be desperately hard,
mm-hmm.
but I'm interested in the process of finding the unclimbed mountain and then working out what route to climb it by. You know, there's a whole lot of sort of interesting project management.
Right. And sort of getting engaged and absorbed in the challenge, I presume.
Yeah. Mm. Both the challenge of kind of planning that trip, finding that mountain, and then the challenge of getting out there on the ground and discovering that what you worked out on Google Earth bears limited resemblance to what you actually discover.
Yes.
And now you've got to take reality and still make your project work. Hmm. So I think people like me who are engaged by the process, we may not be as likely to be world class and record breakers, but we're possibly more likely to be happily involved for our entire lifetime.
Mm. And it's more sustainable, isn't it?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Fabulous. This has been great. This has been really wonderful. Before we go, if my listeners have liked what they've heard and want to know more about you or connect or find out how they can follow you, what are the best places for them to do that?
Right. I would be delighted to connect with the listeners. My personal website, kathyodowd.com, mostly focused on my corporate speaking work. I actively share my current adventures on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy O'Dowd. I'm also on Facebook. I then have a project that any sort of potential adventurers in your audience might find interesting. I run as a side project a website to help people find funding to do adventure.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's not about the inspiration or, you know, that side. That's all covered by other adventurers. It's about the money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And most of us don't talk about that side so much.
Interesting, interesting.
So the website is thebusinessofadventure.com. Twitter, bizofadventure. There's a weekly email that goes out with great resources to help people with the funding side of it. So if anyone's interested in that, please find me at thebusinessofadventure.com.
Wonderful. Kathy, thank you so much. This was great, and I'd love to have you back down the line. So it'd be wonderful to stay connected. And thank you so much once again.
I'd love to. I really love digging into this side of it, as just being asked yet again. Oh, why did you climb Everest?
Right.
What did it feel like on
right.
top?
Yes.
This was so much more fun.
Great,
thanks.
Great. No, thank you very much. Bye for now.
Okay. Bye.
Wow, right? Isn't Kathy amazing? She has so many wonderful insights. And if you're a longtime listener, you know the drill. There are loads of great things for you in the show notes. You can find out how to follow Kathy, learn more about her work, connect with her on social media, and all of that great stuff. And of course, if you like all things risk, do us a favor and give us a rating or a review on iTunes. Share the show or share the episode. You know, these episodes will always be free of charge, but they do involve a lot of work on my part. I have to schedule the guests. I've got to do my homework. We have to have the conversation, which is really the fun part. Then I've got to do some editing. I've got to get the show out. I've got to promote it on social media. So if you could just share the show and help me out a little bit in that regard, that would be great. I would be so very thankful. Subscribe on allthingsrisk.co.uk, allthingsrisk.co.uk, allthingsrisk.com also works, and you can find all the ways in which you can subscribe to the show. If you have any feedback, allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to send that through to me. I would love to hear from you. We will be back next week with another great episode. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.